Hello and welcome to Culture with me.
Hello
Robert
and
Barrow.
Welcome to the 164th edition of Culture
and welcome to Hello and welcome to Culture with me.
Hello
Robert
and
Barrow.
Welcome to a special edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound.
It's been 367 weeks since I first said that opening line, and today it'll be the last, kind of. Yes, this is the final edition of Culture with Robert Bound. We're having a refresh and presenting a new version, more reviewy, from next week. Over the past 6.5 years, this programme has taken me all over the world. We've broadcast from Paris, Doha, LA, New York, Miami, Turin, even Siberia. I've met artists, rock stars, pop stars, directors, actors, curators, writers, philosophers, poets, historians, and people with all sorts of wonderful, obscure jobs. Handwriting experts, sleep doctors, mudlarks, Disney animators, cruise ship acrobats, fashion show makeup artists. On this special last edition, we're going to recycle and celebrate just some of the many, many highlights since the genesis of the show. We couldn't quite fit them all in, but I hope this gives a flavour of all the fun that we've enjoyed. So for the 367th and final time, hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Welcome, wherever you are in the world, to the first Culture show with me, Robert Bound. The idea of the Culture programme is that we make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar. We'll be speaking to film directors.
And we move east from Lebanon now to the desert climes of Qatar. The oil-rich Gulf state is becoming a powerful force in the art world and the art market, with its pockets as deep as an oil well and its acquisitive nature. Doha is home to some mighty impressive museums and galleries. I flew out last week to tread some red carpet at the openings of its autumn exhibitions and caught up with the undoubted star of the show, Damien Hirst, who had not one, but two openings in Doha last week.
On behalf of Qatar Foundation for Education, Science and Community Development, it is therefore an honour for me to stand before you today on what is a momentous occasion, not only for Sidra Medical and Research...
I think anything done well is art, and I think, you know, it's like... I think of that piece by Picasso where he put the bicycle seat with the handlebars to make the bull's head, and you think, oh my God, that moment must have been amazing, because it's like, you know, and, you know, it just constantly says, what does it mean? You don't know why it's good, but it looks great, and it's... So I suppose you're always looking for things like that. A lot of the time, it looks rubbish. And it goes in, you don't show it to anyone.
And I wonder whether you're tempted. You must be keen to know what people think. You obviously know what people think after so long, but whether you ever want to sneak into the private view or more just on a kind of rainy Tuesday and wander around and hear what people are saying, whether in Doha or in London or wherever, are you curious to know what people are thinking about?
I think very early on I looked at it, and you think, because, I mean, you know, I make work that, you know, I'd like people to get passionate about, and I'm very aware that they can be passionately against it as well as passionately for it, so I want to make work that you kind of can't forget rather than work that you love. I mean, I don't expect everybody to love it. I mean, I think that'd be crazy.
Yeah.
But so very early on, I tried to not enjoy the good reviews so that then I could ignore the bad ones. But it's difficult sometimes. I mean, I put an outdoor sculpture into Devon, where I live, which is a big pregnant lady. And as first day when I went to look at it, there were loads of people around it. They didn't recognise me at all. But as I walked down, there was like a 14-year-old girl stood there, and just as I went past, I just heard her saying, oh my God, that's disgusting. So you think...
That was your fake beard she was talking about, your disguise.
Yeah, no, but you can't please everybody, but I think, you know, I mean, it's healthy debate, I like.
My Bed by Tracy Emin was the work that launched the British artist into a media maelstrom on a par with that which surrounded Damien Hirst's Shark. So what happens when a shocking piece of contemporary art ages? Does it become classic, iconic, part of the furniture? I spoke to Tracy Emin about making the bed. Tracy, I wonder whether when you see My Bed in front of you for the first time in a while, whether you feel like you're reunited with an old friend, or whether it's a bit of a challenge from the past.
I think both, really. In some levels, I said it's like a ghost of my past, an old me that doesn't exist anymore. It's just like a fragment or an ether just floating by. And another part of me, just I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it. But today I had to actually get in the bed and pull the covers up and fluff them all up. So that was kind of weird and eerie and awkward, and something did just go through me. I was thinking, wow, 16 years ago, all of this was for real. Now it is for real, but as an artwork. I think a self-portrait is one of the best ways to explain, for people who can't understand it, to say a self-portrait. You can, when you look at it, you actually can have a good idea of what this woman's like, or how she lived, or what she was thinking, or what she was going through. A self-portrait doesn't always just have to be, you know, what you look like. It can be an imprint of who you are.
So we're all at sea on today's show. What sea? The Mediterranean. What ship? The MSC Preziosa. And why? Well, because Monocle magazine's June issue is nautically themed, and so I boarded a cruise in Rome and hopped off in Marseille, but not before getting the lowdown on the world of cruise ship entertainers. Cruises these days are only as good as their onboard entertainment offering, and the Italian MSC line is particularly proud of its glittery gowned acts. Singers, dancers, acrobats, themed nights, animators that spark up any old cocktail bar with a game and some banter, everything is thought of. First of all, we'll meet Franco Pilli, the MSC Preziosa's cruise director, an old hand with a young heart and matchless energy for running around, talking fluently and constantly in half a dozen languages, and being the very voice.
All of them, of course, with the best brands from around the world. Il manager che gestisce tutti I negozi e boutique a bordo, tutte con le migliori marche provenienti da tutto il mondo.
The cruise director is, amongst other things, also the voice of the ship. The cruise director is more one, a guy of the entertainment shows, you know, and that. And they chose to leave the cruise director in his civil clothes, you know, in a sober elegance, but not without the stripes. I'm not sure that's quite appropriate for a cruise director. I mean, I like to be fun on stage, and some cruise director, for example, in some other companies, they tell jokes before they, you know, before they present the shows and so on. You know, if you are in a uniform, somehow you're bound to be a little bit more serious, you know what I mean?
Feel like you should be saluting rather than bowing.
Yeah, a bit more too sober, perhaps, you know. And like I have, like, when I introduce the show, when I come on stage, I have this, which is has become a little bit like my brand. I do like a thing, you know, and it's fun. The people, they laugh because I cannot tell jokes. We have 65 different nationalities and so many different languages. I already speak in the five main languages here in the Mediterranean, which is English, French, Spanish, Italian, and German. So you cannot tell jokes. So what I do is the strange move, you know, and the people, they laugh. You know.
A visual joke, it's good. First, then, to Boy George, a man of many parts, part pop legend, part international superstar DJ, part troubled soul.
We didn't want to do anything that sounded like me trying to be current. You know, I didn't really want to sound like I was trying to fit into, you know, what's going on now, because it's a bit like your uncle kind of putting on a boob tube and sort of trying to be trying to be all trendy. Let's go partying. Yeah. I just wanted to sound... I went back, actually, to all the things that turned me on at sort of 10, 11, yeah. 12, 13, you know, the 70s. I went back to the 70s, which I always do when I'm looking for inspiration or kind of intention, sort of spirit, vibe. And so I went back to all the things, you know, and the 70s was such a bonkers decade for music because you had, you know, glam rock, reggae, you had the Goombe dance band and the Sex Pistols, yeah. Cliff Richard, you know, and your disco, you know, it was all these sort of things that shouldn't have gone together. You know, when you watched some of the pops in the 70s, you never knew what was going to pop up, you know, Gary Glitter, Mrs. Mills, yeah. You know, it was bonkers. And I was so influenced by all of that, you know, when I was growing up. So whenever I'm sort of looking for inspiration, I'll always go back to those people, the Bowies, you know, Roxy Music, Mark Bolan, Joni Mitchell, Dylan, you know, Leonard Cohen, all of those kind of characters. And plus working with Richie Stevens, you know, the drummer and also the producer of the record, he is Mr. kind of understated. It's like, no, there's no need for those chords. Okay. You know, he's one of those, pull it back. And so that was great because it's exactly what I wanted, you know, just to sort of not sound like anyone was trying too hard.
It's really nice hearing the reggae back. I mean, obviously that was one of the key parts of Culture Club when you guys first broke out. That was one of the key things. It was, again, this white reggae that no one had heard. Maybe there was a bit of the Police. Maybe we're doing something vaguely similar, very different style. But that white reggae thing is amazing.
Yeah, I think on these tracks, we've been a bit more authentic. You know, I think with the Culture Club thing, it was a little bit white boy reggae. We've kind of gone for a bit more of a kind of authentic sound with these tracks. But, reggae's always been something that I've loved, you know, since sort of early 70s. That's when I really first heard things like Ken Booth, you know, Johnny Nash, Susan Cadogan and all that kind of really early lovers rock, which is really what first drew me to reggae music.
And that lovers rock is in the soulful voice as well, Susan Cadogan and Marsha Aitken, these kinds of female reggae singers with those amazing voices. Yeah. There's that in this new record of yours, I think, that soul reggae thing.
Yeah, and we also had Dennis Bavell involved, you know, with us as well. So that was just great to have him around, you know, kind of spreading his magic. I don't know if you've ever met Dennis.
No, but I feel like he's walking through the studio with like an incense burner. Not incense.
No, usually with a bag of mangoes, but he's just a force of nature. You know, he's just one of these people that, you know, almost when you're doing reggae records or working on anything in that vibe, if he comes along and kind of just, you know, with his bag of mangoes, you know, you're in the good right area, you know.
I like the idea of that. Sounds like a Rolling Stones rider from the 70s.
I feel like I should write a
bag
song
of mangoes in inverted commas.
I should write a song called Bag of Mangoes.
That, please do that. Please. Maybe that's, you said that you responded to a journalist, but and this is how the album had its title. This is what I did.
I might write that down.
Please,
actually.
Bag of Mangoes.
Bag of Mangoes.
That's the dub LP. Messages in bottles are beguiling objects. They contain love letters, confessions, notes to those who have passed, photographs, hopes and dreams. Nicola White is a mudlark who spends her weekends trawling the River Thames estuaries.
The first one was by accident. It was my dog who found it, came bounding along with a plastic bottle with a little note in it. And after that, I started actively looking for them.
You've got a folder in front of you now with all your messages in. Perhaps you could talk us through a few of those and some of the people that you've come across.
Well, I've got a huge mixture of messages. I think one of my favourite ones has got to be, "I wish I could be a Dino Thunder Power Ranger, the Red Ranger," from Jack Hodges. He didn't have any contact details on it at all, just his name, but through Twitter we did manage to trace this boy, and we sent him a Power Ranger outfit, and he was absolutely thrilled with that, and he wrote back to us with a picture of him in his Power Ranger outfit. I found another one here, actually, which is in the bottle recently, but this one, which is very pleasant, says, "My name is Georgie Manor, England, East London, age 50. Whoever finds this bottle, well done. This will bring you good luck and happiness." And then he gives a phone number. So I contacted the number and eventually I heard back, and it turned out that this person was an ex-armed robber in prison whose friend had thrown this in the river, and he wanted to put something good back into the world. And I had an interesting chat with him. As far as I know, he's still in prison. But I have had lots of good luck and happiness, so... Okay, well, we're near Higham, right next to the Thames estuary.
Are there normally certain spots where you find certain things?
Yeah, no, particularly along the sea wall and in the little nooks and crannies where things tend to accumulate.
So we're looking in the corners.
Yes.
We were talking before we turned the microphone on a little bit about some of these messages, and some of them are quite funny and some of them are quite personal. How do you choose which ones you keep and you investigate and which ones you throw back in the water?
If a message is particularly personal, for example, a month or so ago I found a message in a bottle which was obviously written by a family to a member of their family who had died recently, and I read it and I thought, no, that needs to carry on its journey along the river. So I put it back in the bottle and sent it on its way. I think you need to have due respect for people's feelings, and some things just aren't appropriate to share. You know, it's private. I think there's something symbolic about throwing a message in a bottle in the water, because you're letting go of something, whether it's feelings or emotions. I mean, that's how I look at it. I think you're letting go, and then you have to leave the outcome, really, and see what happens.
Görkem Şen is a 33-year-old Turkish musician. He recently invented a new acoustic instrument, as you do, called the yerebar.
Coiled springs work on it, and this is carry the vibration from strings. That vibrations reach the membrane, and sounds occur and happen.
But there's strings on that, right?
Yeah, there's two strings now, but the first yerebar was 30 strings. 30 strings, yes.
What?
Uh-huh.
And this one's only two?
Yes, this is easy version. But and range, very good range. I mean, this is 5 octave, playable 5 octave and more.
I didn't also realize you do have a violin bow, or something that looks like a violin bow here.
Yeah, bow. It's horse tail bow, yes.
Mm-hmm. You can bow the strings.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Can you play a bit of that for me?
On the strings, lots of technique you can use. Harmonic touchings, finger, and also fingernail, and also little touchings.
The old post-Christmas London was decorated instead by high cheekbones, aquiline noses and fine tailoring. For Men's Fashion Week was in town, and we thought, how do you put on a fashion show? And indeed, that is the question that we're asking tonight. Who better to answer it than Patrick Grant, the governor and creative director of the venerable outfitter E-Torts. Cool yet traditional, proudly British.
That's nice. Head this way slightly. That's it, brilliant. A little bit more relaxed.
Good morning, Patrick. Here we are, bright and fresh at 180 The Strand, backstage. And it's 7:45 in the morning. We're being kind with the time. When did you get here, and what's going on around us?
Well, we were in the studio about 6 o'clock just to load the van. We're backstage now. What we're doing, hair and makeup are here, the guys from Tony and Guy are here, the team from Mac are here, and most of the boys have arrived, an unusually high proportion of the boys, given that they were supposed to be here at 7, it's now, well, it's 7:55, and almost all of them are here.
We're in good shape then, really?
I think we're in pretty good shape. I mean, the team are just doing final tweaks, making sure that hem lengths are right and final bits of fitting. So there's a bit of sewing going on at the moment, but yeah.
And it's fantastic to have this backstage access. It's amazingly photogenic, like the backstage areas of any films, that of any undertaking that is all about show is about. There is something very show about the backstage part, yeah, of it as well. There's a kind of palpable excitement about it. Is this yeah, the part of the thing that kind of gives you a bit of a buzz about it as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is great. I mean, this is the time where you see, you know, all of these amazing looking guys finally wearing all of these outfits that we've spent 6 months working on. You know, you look around the room here, we've got a rail for every model, we've got the model's card, their photographs, the photographs of their outfits. You know, there's a big team here. There's a lot of people working backstage here. I mean, there's probably 30-odd people between dressers, hair, our own team, makeup. I mean, in about an hour's time, this place will be rammed with photographers from all of the world's sort of media agencies. It becomes a bit of a scrum, actually. You know, just with an hour to go, it really gets pretty full. We'll be rehearsing in probably about 35 minutes. Hopefully all of the boys will be here for the rehearsal. But yeah, you start to feel a little bit nervous excitement.
You've been listening to the 11:45 edition of The Big Story.
Guests may well hold the title for most breakfast shows listened to ever. They are Seb, Amina and Daniel Jones, and they've set up Global Breakfast Radio, an online station that chases the sunrise around the globe. It streams around 15 minutes of live radio from wherever in the world. It's breakfast time, and it covers over 250 stations in more than 120 countries and broadcasts in over 50 languages.
Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Whatever their Lord intended guidance for them.
I think
this is what you're talking about.
swim lessons, maybe you could get the Red Cross or somebody down here and bring people in to get lifeguard lessons.
Chip Gard from the National Weather Service expects the following damage as a result of the storm. The possibility of tin roofing becoming airborne now.
The last time I logged on to Global Breakfast Radio, your website, your station, I was halfway between WCPN 90.3 in Cleveland, Ohio, and a radio station, I think it's WMMT in Winesburg, Kentucky. Do you curate what you put on there, or is it, I mean, it's not a random stream. Obviously, you take a kind of straw poll of the radio stations around the world and decide in what order to put them, I guess.
We do curate it, yeah. We've spent a long time, it's been almost 18 months now, that we've been kind of travelling the world through this medium of internet radio, seeking out stations from every single different time zone. So we'll be looking from country to country, trying to pick out the highlights of breakfast radio at that time, which means that we've really been having to listen to the radio around the clock as well. And it's been a fantastic kind of voyage for us, particularly trying to pick out radio stations that are broadcasting from these tiny islands in the middle of the Atlantic and the Pacific, places like French Polynesia and Papua New Guinea and Guam. And these have been some of the real highlights for us, I think, like finding local radio stations intended for local people that you can still pick up wherever you are through this medium of radio.
So talk us through a couple of the ones that our listeners, as international as they are, might not have heard. You mentioned French Polynesia, various different places. We were talking about small radio stations in the Bahamas and things. But tell us some of your favourite ones. When it's, say, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here in the UK and you guys are like, right, we've got to get on to somewhere in the flyover states of the United States, for example.
Well, at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, I think it's around breakfast time in Alaska, I would guess, on the West Coast. And there's a wonderful radio station broadcasting from a small promontory, I think, is that right? Called Unalaska in Alaska that plays a lot of weird and wonderful North American music. And there's a whole lot of college rock stations as well on the West Coast, yeah, that we've been incorporating, as well as the more kind of esoteric, far outside of things. There's a great station called SF Sound broadcasting from San Francisco that's kind of an art radio station. And really one of the things that we're trying to do is pick out stuff that is quite characteristic of those places, as well as trying to create a kind of global portrait, really, of all of the esoteric and all of the kind of mundane and everyday that exists across the world.
I mean, it's not always cheery. It's not always, you know, hey, pop listeners, you know, have a great day.
Hey,
today.
Kids, thanks for tuning in.
Exactly, all that stuff. And sometimes it's surprising how opposed to maybe the British idea of breakfast radio these stations can get. I mean, SF Sound, the art stations, they make no concession to breakfast at all. It'd be like clicks and shuffles and discordant saxes, all that kind of thing. There's no concept of breakfast there or morning. It doesn't matter.
Tribute bands, like much of the music industry, tend to be the preserve of men. But there are a few all-female tribute bands to be found, and if you have a soft spot for mid-90s college rock, then we've found just the one for you. Sheezer, the all-female Weezer tribute band from Toronto, specialise in only playing the first two records from the band, The Blue One and Pinkerton, and have gathered an enthusiastic fan base in the 4 years since they were founded. They've been rocking Eastern Canada since 2009, and Marcella's went to meet them.
We're not actually trying to be members of the band, especially since we rotate the singing duties. So 3 out of 4 of us are rippers at any given time.
Laura Barrett, bass player and founding member on The Origins of Sheezer.
Dana and I, Dana is the drummer, we were traveling back to Toronto from Pop Montreal, I think, and listening to Pinkerton pretty much on repeat. It was a tradition in the van. And Dana, you know how people come up with fake band names all the time? She was just listening to it and said, hey, you know, we could make an all-girl cover band and we'd call it Sheezer. Done. Just, it had to happen. That was really it. It was just a band name and a concept that said it all. We had a MySpace before we had a gig. The touring has been really exciting. We went out west opening for Born Ruffians and got to play a lot of large venues to crowds that, because Born Ruffians are so popular, it widened our audience and our reach. And it got a lot of women and girls at those shows seeing women playing rock instruments, which I didn't think was such a huge deal, but they would come up to us afterward and say, like, oh, now I know that, oh, you know, this is a surprise, basically, is what they were saying. It was a pleasant surprise for them, or, you know, girls really can rock, which is kind of a terrible thing to hear.
First up, we're sitting down with a self-professed piano genius, Chilly Gonzalez, you know, for a lesson.
So we have this pentatonic scale. I just want to point out that in some Asian cultures, they only have these five notes. And that's why you can do this kind of borderline culturally insensitive kind of parody. You know, you could kind of do that kind of so-called Asian music in a sort of very stereotypical manner with these black keys. But it's interesting that you can divide up the octave, which is the distance between this and this. There's 12 notes, but different cultures have different numbers of scale. They divide it up differently, so to speak. So the blues scale is only the black notes, which you pointed out were this. And we just add in this note here. Can you play that for me, Rob? Okay. So that is the blues scale now. So in theory, we now have all the tools that Jerry Lee Lewis had for his right hand. So one exercise we can try is to go like this. This is a classic Jerry Lee Lewis riff. All right? And so you have to remember that you have this whole scale, but you want to orient always, and then use the others to fill in. That's one way you could possibly start. Should we try that?
So this is like this, right?
Yeah.
Something's exactly. Not right there.
Yeah, what you want to do is you want to use this as a kind of little step. This is called an appoggiatura. The note that people hear is this, but to give a little bit of swagger, what you do is you play the immediate neighbor note either below or above. In this case, it's below. So we have a B flat, that's our destination note, and we're going to play the A natural right below it, right? Okay. That's the essence of the blues right there. Can you hear it? Can you hear the life I've lived?
Yeah. That's right. Got to... I can feel that you woke up this morning and something happened to you. Someone left you this morning. I can hear that just in that note.
Either my dog or my wife clearly left me, and only this Jack Daniels can fix it, right? Okay. So you see that you hit normally, but the B flat has that little appoggiatura, the little blue note. And then you can fill in with any of the black notes. You ready?
Now, I've rarely seen Dalston in the daylight. Why? Because I love being in the romantic dark of the Rio Cinema, of course. We went to see boss man Oliver Meek to tell us how he runs the Rio.
So, we're going to go through to the projection room now.
By the way, this sort of holding room, this antechamber, is pure cinema, isn't it? The reels of old films stacked up here, the cardboard boxes with all sorts of fame. Well, what have we got? Mrs. Doubtfire, Toy Story, Spy Kids 3D, various titles up here. This is presumably the old-fashioned film.
This is the inner sanctum. This is the kind of beating heart of any cinema. Yeah. And this is, of course, where our projectionists work. And nothing would happen without them. So it's a really important space. And we're, you know, lots of cinemas now don't have, because of the changes in technology, don't have, you know, proper projection rooms. So it's something we're still very proud of. And I'll show you inside in a moment the old 35mm projector and all the old reels. So let's go and have a look inside.
Sure.
Okay, come on in.
Oh, wow, yeah. We've got the whir, presumably, of the projector itself, of the air conditioning to cool it down.
We feel like we're
in the heart of the belly of the beast here.
Yeah, they have to be kept very cool all the time because the lamps get very hot. And this is the old 35mm projector here.
There's something about hot machinery, perhaps the idea of hot film, maybe not being projected right now, but it sort of lingers in the air and in the dust in here, doesn't it? You've been in the cinema business for a while. Rooms like this must be one of the reasons why you do it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, there's an incredible kind of romance around this. And actually, any time I take anyone for a tour of the Rio, and it's an incredible building with all these kind of nooks and crannies, but it's when they come in here and, you know, this really feels timeless.
On this week's show, we sent producer Holly Fisher cross-country to Cardiff for a new exhibition at the city's National Museum. The work under investigation is a new commission by the Icelandic artist Ragnar Kjartansson, the man who marries together music and art in beautifully repetitive and performative ways. This particular piece is called The Sky in a Room and centres around a performer playing the same song on repeat on an old, ornate organ in the museum. I'm going to leave you...
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at some of your past pieces, like the national performance that you did where they performed Sorry for 6 hours, was it? And by the end of that performance, they're wearing the song. You know, you can see it in every crevice in their body and they're sort of aching with it. Are you more interested in how the performer deals with this repetition or how the audience sees it as they're watching it?
I'm just interested in both. And interested in, you can mainly maybe how a performer embraces it. How you embrace a song and just like dive into it. And it's really beautiful to watch performers do that. And, you know, for audiences, I always have no expectations, which I think is like, is what I like from art pieces. I really, as an audience myself, I really never like to be told what I should feel or get from it. It's just like it's just there.
But when I guess as well, when you're making art where you're relying on someone else to do the performance, are you sometimes surprised by your own reaction to the things you've made?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I was like, for this piece, I was very happy with the piece and very, you know, sometimes you get this sort of confident feeling like, yeah. But now when I saw it, it was actually, yeah, it was actually really moving. Because it stops being, you know, what I was planning. It just becomes their performance, and they are great. It's just like a great group of people who are performing it, like, very beautifully.
And I wonder how you listen to music just when you're at home. Do you like to listen to songs on repeat? Because I will sometimes listen to one song over and over again for one day, and some people think I'm a bit crazy for that. But I wonder, when you feature repetition of songs so much in your work, if that's how you listen to music at home as well?
Yeah, I listen to it a lot like that. It's always this, like, just once more. You know, when I fall in love with a song, it's just, you know, can I just play one more time?
You can never have too many times.
No. It's always one more time. Yeah. So, yeah, I just really love that. And, you know, like that old thing you did as a kid to, like, put a song on a cassette, repeat it, and, yeah, maybe it comes from that. But it's also like, yeah, just like you say, it really comes from real life. Like, we really like listening to stuff again and again.
But I always think it's quite interesting because in some places in the world, that's used as torture.
Yeah. I think, you know, it definitely, I mean, like, they use this method in Guantanamo. They use this method in Guantanamo Bay to repeat a song, but they don't use Il Cielo in una Stanza. They use just Born in the USA. And, you know, I think that is... That could be torture.
Okay, and this is the Culture Show Quiz Show, and I'm your host, Robert Bound. Our contestants today are Mark Mason and John Mitchinson, and they'll be battling it out for our top prize, a much-coveted bag of chocolate coins.
Woo!
Okay, you both have a ready-made selection of buzzers in front of you. John, would you like to choose your buzzer noise first? Very nice. A depth charge sort of warning there. Mark, what's going to be your buzzer? Very nice. A coily spring. Slightly... What?
No, I just want to make it again.
It's pretty good news, isn't it? Question two. This is trivia. The next two questions are popular pub quiz questions. Mark, this is your territory. Which five underground stations, London underground stations, have the word town in their name?
Go on, you can do
it. Okay, well, I'm going to try and work it out as I go. Okay. Acton Town, Sudbury Town. There is. You see, that's I've written a book on the tube and I'm
Canning
used to
Town.
Canning Town.
Very good, John. Two towns.
Kentish Town and Camden
Town. Kentish
Town
and Camden
Town. Yes. Town, and Camden Town. Oh, I think we have to split
the... I was in a pub quiz the other night and a coot tube question
that's
came
a good
up.
Question. That's a good question. That's a good, good question. We got all the hard ones. See, that's the problem.
We're too good.
This week, we make our annual pilgrimage to the Green Man Festival in the Welsh Brecon Beacons.
We ran the festival in the Brecon Beacons National Park, and we first went to the site. It literally was a farm with a bungalow in the middle of it with a big back garden. And we got driven around by the owner at 100 miles an hour around this estate. Anyway, we drove around and it was one of those classic things that they drove us through this beautiful, used to be a deer park that was there. It was amazing. And we looked up and you could see the Black Mountain. I mean, it was just amazing, full of sheep. I mean, it was a farm. And then as we went round, I said, oh, we'll meet up in this car park and in near the house. And I don't know, there isn't a big estate, a big country pile there. There is this kind of bungalow that's in the middle of it. Anyway, we drove, it was like, stop the car. And we got out, literally fell out of the car. Fell out of the car and looked... And suddenly realised, and we were in this back garden of this house, and we suddenly looked at it and realised that if we actually developed it, we could create it into an amphitheatre. So it literally was from the ground up. There was nothing there, and bless them, the people there I think they thought we were mad, but we moved all this earth and dug all these things out and got it together and. The amphitheatre that you see the mountain stage in, which is one of the most fantastic things, that's what it was. It was an elderly lady's, retired lady's garden that we took over and moved it into what it is now.
I think there's moments when you overhear people in discussion at a bar or something,
yeah.
And they're talking about an act they've seen that day or... you know, an experience they've had, a workshop they've been to, any experience on site. And then once you hear people say, oh, my God, I loved James Blake last night. Did you see that? And then I went to Charlotte Church's Pop Dungeon. And, like, you know, and that's a moment where you kind of step back and go, OK, people are having a wonderful time. You know, with Laura Marling, this will be the third time she's played, and obviously headlining Saturday night at the festival feels like a... for me, like an amazing thing for her to be doing for us. You know, she's done incredibly well in her career. And for her to now be headlining Green Man for the third appearance here is pretty special.
It's a bit of a homecoming in many ways.
Yeah,
she was here right back in the early days.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a good fit.
Yeah, I've seen her walking around today as well. And she's taking it all in, I think, you know.
And in terms of that, Laura wandering around, kind of going, oh, these guys, and being very much part and parcel.
Is that your Laura voice?
It's a bit too similar to my actual voice. I didn't want to kind of do, hi, my name's Laura Marling, and I'm going to be presenting.
Okay.
Well, that's it for Culture with Robert Bowne. Thanks to everyone who's worked on the show since it began in October 2011. Katie Bilboa, Daphne Denny, and of course, Holly Fisher. Next Monday, we'll be starting a brand new arts programme in this slot called the Monocle Culture Show, Spot the Difference. This will be the new home of in-depth reviews that pull criticism in slightly different directions, we hope. So please do join us then as we take Wes Anderson's new film, Isle of Dogs, as our first subject. This episode was produced by the wunderbar Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. As ever, thanks for tuning in.